Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lil Tullis, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Jorge Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. Today we are talking with singer-songwriter-musician Luke Jenner, founding member of the band The Rapture. You may know The Rapture from their songs How Deep Is Your Love, Echoes, and House of Jealous Lovers. Their music has been described as brilliant and their live shows as primal digifunk and the greatest liberation. The Rapture begins a national tour in September and then a European tour in November. So check out The Rapture's music, tour info, and merch at therapturemusic.com. Now, on the Going There podcast, we have the tough conversations to address important issues so we can learn from each other, challenge the stigma of mental illness, and get the care we need. And one of the most difficult issues that we struggle with on our mental health journey is hopelessness, particularly as it relates to dealing with mental illness in our family. And Luke talks about hopelessness, particularly in the context of his relationship with his mother, who he described as suffering from bipolar disorder. And I want to give a trigger warning here. We will be talking about both suicide and sexual abuse. This includes Luke struggling with what he described as his mother's repeated threats to kill herself and her eventual suicide in 2006. And one of the things that creates a sense of hopelessness when we struggle with a range of issues, including coping with a mentally ill family member, is that we simply don't have any clear pathway as to how to feel, think, or what to do. The hopelessness can come from a range of sources. How do we help and save this person who we care about so much? How do we understand the complicated emotions we have towards someone who we love but who struggles? And how do we find any sense of peace, safety, and security in this situation? And so Luke talks about a range of his experiences, including feeling unlovable and struggling with anger and rage. And he talked about the various escapes that he used, including drinking, drugs, and music. Now, Luke shares with us some of the strategies that he used not only to stay alive, but also to channel his feelings so that he can cope and help others cope through his music and work as a life coach. Now, as we progress through this season of Going There, our goal is to bring you, the audience, further into the conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions you have that have been sparked by our conversations with these incredible artists, and topics you'd love to see addressed. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. These help other folks find their way into the conversation so they can go there with us. So let's go there and listen to what Luke has to say. Hey, Luke, welcome to Going There.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So we talked a little bit beforehand. The lyric, "I've seen no way out since I was a boy." So many people, when they're in the midst of it, whatever they're going through, that moment happens. They just don't see it. And then the question is, what do you do? How do you keep going when there is that kind of hopelessness?
When I wrote that lyric, I was trying to save my mom. There's tiers to this question, right? So it's like I've dealt with it at different times. Like originally, the way out was to make my mom not kill herself. My mom committed suicide in 2006. When I was 18 or 19, Kurt Cobain killed himself. And she had a copy of Time magazine. And she was like, "Do you know this guy? I know this guy is like a hero of yours. He's bipolar. I'm bipolar. You might be bipolar. One out of three bipolar people kill themselves. You might kill yourself. Good luck." You know, and so I was like, you know, and she had tried to commit suicide when I was 16 and at various other times in my life. And so I've seen no way out since I was a boy. It was really first about keeping her alive. Then when she left Earth when I was 31, it shifted to now I got to take care of myself and I don't know how to find the way out. And I searched for a lot of different things. The three real loves of my life, which were a way out, was first baseball. I was completely, you know, baseball chose me. The best things in my life really have chosen me. I haven't chosen them. You know, I didn't choose a suicidally depressed mom. So, you know, baseball saved me until it didn't. I got to high school and I was in high school and I was on the varsity baseball team. And I was in the outfield grass with my best friends. And they were talking about anally raping their prom dates. And I was just like, I can't hang out with you guys anymore. And I had been sexually abused as a kid, but I wasn't ready to really deal with that yet. Or it wasn't even in my consciousness until in my 30s and my mom had tried to tell me and she was, you know, sexually abused. And like, so the way out has been a varied thing. I mean, really, in a sense, like you're having a question of divinity or the universe or how do you relate? Like if religion means to realign yourself with reality, the way out is to realign yourself with reality however you can. But reality moves. Like, you know, God is a feeling, not an idea, and it shifts all the time. The way out is constantly shifting. So there's been baseball, there's been music was a way out, my romance was a way out, and then finally finding recovery is a way out, and then combining all those things. You know, I moved a lot of times, that was a way out. In 12 steps, they call that doing a geographic. So, you know, it's like it just moved to a new place, but then all my problems followed me. So long term, the real way out is to not hate yourself anymore. I think most people believe that they're fundamentally unlovable. So if you knew everything about them, then you'd have to run away. And the real way out for me is to kind of blow up that idea through all of those things I discussed, plus going to therapy. Like I've done all the things. I've done drugs. I've done therapy. I've done 12 steps. And I work with clients that do all that stuff now. So I think that there's not a one-size-fits-all answer. There's just a lot. It's like music. You know, you get into music, you start listening to music, you get into this thing, and it leads to that thing, and you identify with this, or, you know, something really heavily influences you for a couple of years, and it doesn't work anymore, and then you come back to it.
Well, let's, if you're okay with it, talk about this idea of being unlovable. You know, I always bristle at that concept because it implies when people say I'm unlovable, one, I don't like when people are unkind to themselves, but, you know, you have to be able to listen to, hey, someone's in pain when they're saying that. But the premise of it is that any of us knows what lovable is.
Yeah, what love is, right? Like, it's arrogant. Like, I get really uncomfortable once people start in a prescriptive way telling me what the universe is or what God is or what any, you know, I'm like, that's a really arrogant statement. Like, our brains are so tiny. So to tell me you're unlovable, I would agree with you. However, I do feel very cautious with that. You know, like, I've read books about therapists working in, you know, mental institutions, and someone will be like, the aliens are coming to get me. The worst thing you can do is say, like, there's no aliens. You know, you have to be like, cool, when are they coming? Like, what do they look like? And then, you know, kind of talk to them. And I think when somebody says they're unlovable, the easiest thing to do is be like, what do you mean? Well, why? And then kind of like to have a conversation. And then, you know, you kind of very quickly get to like, well, do you think I'm unlovable? Like, or like, I've had those experiences. Does that make me, or your friend that you love, does that make them unlovable? And you can very quickly kind of pull them out of that, I think.
Yeah. So the question is, when we are feeling like we're unlovable, right? What we're talking about, to some degree, it's almost faith-based to counteract that, because, you know, what you're talking about is like, look, these different institutions have already failed me. You know, again, getting back to the concept, like, as a boy. You know, you're not in a position where you've had all this life experience. You can't say, well, you know, I found my different things. I found my places. Yeah, it's entirely faith-based at that point. I'm just kind of, if you can kind of remember back to that, it's like, how did you say there's all this evidence in front of me that I don't see a way out? I don't feel lovable. I'm dealing with all these problems. Like, how do you keep going in a situation like that?
And I think I was born with a certain baseline level of, I've always been an optimist. You're bringing up a memory for me. When I was a little boy, and I lived in Hawaii till I was seven, and when I lived in Hawaii, my dad was surfing every day and being a university professor. My mom was an art therapist, and she taught like the quote-unquote bad kids. But I had this music box, and when I was really sad, I would hide, and I would listen to this music box. When you open the music box, it would play Swan Lake in tinkly sounds, and I had a ballerina that would spin around, and I would almost like meditate on this song and this ballet, and I would manifest, I would believe that there was a ballet dancer who was going to come and rescue me, and my wife is a ballet dancer, and she rescued me. You know, I once asked a priest, you know, what, how do you pray? And he's like, well, you're doing it. You know, it's like prayer just means talking with intention, and meditation is listening with intention. So intention, I think, is probably the most powerful tool we have as humans.
And so one thing that, you know, when people talk about the idea even of a higher power, like one of the things I've always appreciated when people are in recovery is that it doesn't have to be this all encompassing higher power. It's just, is there anything above you? Is there anything more than you?
You know, God is not like a dude with thunderbolts and a beard in the sky. Also, like, I believe in the sort of internal family systems model of, there is no such thing as unified consciousness. We're all collections of people. So at different ages created through trauma. Like the main part of me was created through dropping a fish tank on the way up some stairs. And as a 4-year-old and feeling like one of the fish died and that I couldn't let anyone ever get hurt again. And navigating my way into higher power or something greater than myself was getting through this worldview. Like if you ask most people, how do they feel about the universe or God or whatever, they'll just tell you, or the state of the world, they'll just tell you how they feel about their parents most of the time. Your parents are a power greater than yourselves. Like you can't feed yourself, you can't move your arm. So I think, but there's all these different parts of me and they all have different feelings. Like some parts of me are atheists, some of them are super into Christianity, another part is like a Buddhist, the other one thinks all that is stupid but is open. Like there is no, and I think any faith that doesn't include doubt is not very strong.
Yeah, and so I guess one thing that you're saying back to the ballerina concept, and this is a, I think, something that where music is particularly powerful, it's like I guess what we'd be suggesting to somebody is start with a focus on anything. It doesn't even have to feel good necessarily, but just start with a focus on something that feels a little less bad.
I guess. I mean, you know, like everybody loves something. Like my dad's higher power is the ocean and he's a surfer and any body of water makes him feel something. And my mom was a gardener. And my tribute to my parents is I have a lot of aquariums with plants in my house, just like the combined, and there's something very comforting about that. And I also used to go to a fish store when I was a kid and I felt sad. I would ride my bike there, and you know, my mom was suicidal or something was going on in my house that didn't feel good, I would just get on my skateboard and go to the fish store and disappear into the fish tank and like literally almost like put my spirit into the body of water. And when I was in high school, I had a 4-foot aquarium and I used to just almost like meditate with the fish. I would lay next to the fish tank. And like anyone listening to this probably likes music. And it's like, well, how do you know music as well? It makes me cry or it helps me feel my anger. Like anger was a really important part of me breaking out of this thing we're talking about. Like I had to learn how to be angry safely. My mom in the family system was the person who felt all of the anger and no one else was allowed to feel that. And so in a way, like, to have to find the way out, I had to learn how to, you know, and that was a process. That was really difficult. I think that was probably the most treacherous part of my recovery 17 years ago, was just feeling like it was okay to be angry. And that was also something that happened on stage. Like I could be angry on stage. I couldn't be angry in my regular life, but if I was angry on stage, I could tell that it was helping other people and that made it okay.
Are you okay with talking a little bit about that? Because that path, I think a lot of people find treacherous, you know, especially if you've been in a situation where the anger, you know, especially if someone's bipolar, you can make the assumption that the anger is not always coming out in a particularly constructive way.
No filter.
You know, and so how did you conceptualize that and manage that and express it?
For me, humor is a really important conduit to anger. And my mom is British and she was a master of sarcasm and she used humor. I think for me, healing humor really allowed me to be funny safely. To be funny, you have to be really smart. And particularly in a romance, you know, my wife thinks I'm funny. Most people don't think I'm a funny person because it's very intimate and I don't express my humor openly. But when I really love somebody, I'm funny to them. And it shows a certain sensitivity and an intelligence, and it shows an anger. Particularly British people, or the French are very close to British in terms of their sarcasm. But sarcasm is really subverting anger through this kind of, like, they use humor to make anger safe. And at its finest, sarcasm is a healing force, and at its worst, it's a complete destruction.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's tough is because when we might be ready for humor, but when other people are not and they experience it as angry, it can be kind of tough because you almost want to then backtrack and be like, no, I was trying to...
You can break an entire relationship with a joke. That is the power of language and humor. I mean, you can kill your entire family system in one sentence, like literally.
Yeah. On that point, because you're talking about the family system concept. One of the things that I think a lot of people struggle with in the context of the family, and you said something about your mom's kind of giving you this explanation, you know, I'm bipolar. Kurt Cobain was bipolar. You might be bipolar, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I think that that's one of the toughest things that people deal with is there's a whole way that one has to protect themselves from someone else when they're in a difficult place. And then knowing that you are experiencing from the other end some of those same things can be very disorienting. You know, it's like, I know what this felt like when it was happening to me, but now I'm feeling it in me a little bit.
Oh, 100%. I mean, my entire college career, so it was just, I just wanted to know how to not kill myself. You know, like my kid's in college, he goes to Oberlin and he's like really, you know, he's doing great. He's not shackled with these things, but I met this guy in junior college named Paul Wheatcroft, and he was the first person I ever met who'd liked himself, and it just blew my mind. And I wanted it. And I took every class that he taught. I went to his office hours. He'd be like, why are you here? I'd be like, I don't know. I just feel great when I'm around you. And he'd be like, okay, fine. I got to grade some papers. Sit over there. And when he retired, I followed him across the parking lot, and I was like, please don't leave. And he was like, you're going to be okay. I was totally not okay. And I took a lot of other, I went, my dad taught at state school, so I got free school. So, and I wanted to move to San Francisco. My best friend, drummer of the Rapture, was going to study film in San Francisco because he got really good grades. He had a really good film department. I just followed him there. I, in tears one night, I said, can I go with you? And he said, okay. And his parents dropped me off in this neighborhood with like gunshots and stuff. Like, and I slept on this person's couch, and I eventually the next semester got in, and I took all these philosophy classes. And my kid loves this story because I was in a class about Nietzsche, and the professor was one of the world's leading scholars of Nietzsche, and she was super brilliant. Nietzsche's really brilliant, but Nietzsche like hates himself, and he had a really troubled life, and she really was struggling in her life. And that was the moment at which I quit philosophy school, and I just booked a tour and went on tour, because it was like, I don't want to learn how to do intellectual somersaults or talk in a way that is attractive or makes people like me. I want to not kill myself. And I think, you know, if I could have majored in not killing myself, that's what I would have done. But philosophy was the closest thing.
Can we talk about how you were feeling back then? And then what were the steps that got you to avoid suicide?
Oh, 100%. Well, I drank a lot, and drinking saved my life. My dad drank a lot, and my family, you know, there's a lot of drinking, you know, drug addiction and stuff like that. My dad gave me some instructions. He was like, you can drink as much as you want. Don't do heroin and stay away from crystal meth because those are really hard. But he's like, drink as much as you want, smoke weed. I was more into drinking than smoking weed. I did smoke some weed. Those things really saved my life. You know, I'm very grateful to my drinking, particularly because it just allowed me to make it. A lot of times when I have clients under 30 or I run into people under 30, the first thing I say to them is just don't die before you're 30. And they always giggle. And I'm like, no, I'm actually fucking, I'm super serious about this. Like, you know, you're not going to get your, and this is something that doesn't really get talked about very much, but I don't, people don't really get their feelings fully until they're like 32, 33. And so you can't really make a decision back to this faith thing. Well, like, how do you know God exists or what? It's like, You don't know. And like, you don't know what you don't like. I had an emotional awakening, and I include emotions in my higher power too, or what, you know, but it's like, just don't die before you're 30. And if you got to drink, or, you know, you got to make out with people you don't like, or distract yourself with music, like, you can't have a relationship based on sex, drugs, or rock and roll. Like, those things are all sacramental and will get you to, like, you know, I've had, like, I don't do drugs anymore, but I've had psychedelic experiences that I found helpful. Like, once I took, in Seattle when I lived there, I went to a Robert Fripp show. And at the Robert Fripp show, someone gave me mushrooms, because in Seattle, there's free mushrooms everywhere in the summer. And all the stoners, like, collect the mushrooms, and they have their own personal spot where, like, behind the baseball field, there's a field of mushrooms. And they collect all the mushrooms and give them their friends. So someone's like, do you want some mushrooms? I took those mushrooms, and I remember sitting at the bar at this Robert Fripp show in my early 20s. I was with my best friend's girlfriend, who became his wife at the time, and there was this picture underneath the glass bar of a woman that looked like my mom, and I just started weeping. And she's like, are you okay? And I'm like, I think so. I feel really good. I was really high on mushrooms, and I just cried for like 2 hours. I didn't even see the show, really. So I think those experiences are important. And like, whatever you got to do. I mean, when I first got in AA, my sponsor would just be like, if you have to eat a pint of ice cream, just like, don't drink or whatever. You know, there's some time, or just like, if you have to listen to music all day. I remember before the winter that my mom killed herself, it was Christmas Eve. And I was really into reading books, and I would go to the library and carry so many books home that I could barely walk home. And I got in this particular history series, and I was reading, and it was Christmas Eve, and I had been reading for 2 days straight with almost no breaks. And my wife came in with tears in her eyes, and she was like, are you going to hang out with me and your kid because it's Christmas Eve? And I said, you know, if I stop reading right now, I'm going to collapse, and I'm not going to be able to breathe. I'm not going to be able to do anything. So I just have to like read this book. I'm really sorry. When we move next door in a couple of months, I'll go back to therapy and I'll do something else. But right now I just need to read. So I think the answer is whatever works for you in the moment. You know, I mean, obviously you can't read yourself into being a parent, or you can't rock and roll yourself into being in a successful marriage, but like, use what you got.
No, and I think on this podcast, I think Nikki Sixx actually said something that really stuck with me, which was when he's going and talking to people about addiction, the first thing he says when he goes to prisons is like, let's talk about what's great about drugs.
Totally.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of like what you were saying before, but if someone talks about aliens.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, like I have so many people that I work with who are like, I don't, you know, I drank again last night, or I used last night. I have no idea why. It's like, you have no idea why. I can give you 20 reasons right now, and I wasn't even there. And I tend to think that life works better predominantly with sobriety, but I also, you know, I didn't get to that without trying. And I think that there is a way that it's very important that, like, I think what you said makes a lot of sense. It's like, it's not just the thing itself, it's the function of it.
100%.
And you have to ask yourself, like, well, if someone says, okay, stop drinking, whatever, which I, you know, I generally think is the healthy thing to do, but you can't do it without asking yourself, but what function was it serving?
What the founders of AA figured out a long time ago is, you know, codependency is the root of all addictions, and codependency is actually stronger than addiction. And codependency just means messy boundaries. So they figured out, like, if I'm focused on keeping this other person sober, then I don't have to drink anymore. And that was the same thing with being in a band or being on a baseball team or being a coach. I don't do anything unless somebody's waiting for me. I know that this morning my clients were waiting for me, and so I show up. You know what I mean? And there's something really beautiful about that. Like, I don't heal by myself. If I'm not healing, it's not my fault. It just means that I don't have the right support yet. Like, I couldn't start The Rapture without my best friends. You know, I couldn't make my first record without people encouraging me. Yeah, do it. Like, there's this idea of permission that I think is super powerful. I can tell you where I was when somebody gave me permission to move to New York City, start a band, get married, get sober, become a coach, like anything, you know, like permission is to trust somebody, to have somebody in your life that you trust who has a felt experience. The thing I like about coaching versus therapy, and there's all different people do this all different ways, but as a coach, I'm very willing to share my experience if it's valuable. And I learned that in 12 steps. You know, it's like, well, if I'm going to be sober, I need to know, A, that you felt the same pain as I did, and that, like, how you got out of it. You know what I mean? Like, I want to have your lived experience. And so I think that that's a very critical. That's how I learned music. It was DIY. You know, my 18th birthday, I went to go see U2 in a, you know, radio contest in San Diego at the San Diego Sports Arena. Pixies were opening up and it was great. And I was in line outside with these Mexican guys that were super funny. We were making cow noises because we didn't know if we were going to get in the show. And like, I got in and Bono called the president from the stage. And, you know, I was like, I can't do that. Like, that's not making me want to pick up a guitar or sing on a stage. But then I started going to shows 4 or 5 nights a week at local venues, and I saw people my age and I was like, I could play guitar better than that idiot. You know what I mean? And that was the thing that inspired me.
Let's get back to this codependency thing, because I hear what you're saying on one level, but you kind of had the independence to be distinct from your mom. And what you're talking about right now, the DIY concept of being able to say, like, I'm watching something, I'm not a part of this right now, I'm going to create that on my own, is not that radically different than what you did as a kid, in the sense that there, so when you're saying codependence, I'm not hearing codependence in that. I'm hearing actually fierce independence in both of those things.
It's a spectrum. It's not an either or. You can't have black without white. You know, there is no fear without faith. So it's, where are you in that spectrum of things?
But how do you know, at least from my perspective, one of the things that I'll struggle with is, how do you know when to disconnect?
Oh, your body tells you. I mean, I've seen No Way Out since I was a boy. I love this idea. Thank you so much.
Well, you wrote it, so I mean.
I know. You're tying into my ego.
But I'm gonna take credit for
no,
it.
No, please take credit. It's so great.
I wrote a lot of other good songs that you might be familiar with.
Yeah, but like you know, I love song lyrics because they are like secret messages to myself, and a lot of times it takes me a long time to unpack them, and I'll be like, that's exactly what I was talking about. And sometimes it shifts, but fierce independence versus, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I lost my train of thought there. What exactly were you trying to push me towards?
Well, the way I think about sometimes self-talk, if you're saying something about yourself, if someone else said that to you, right? Yeah. If someone else said to you, yeah, you can't do anything. You're codependent. You can't do anything unless someone tells you. My first reaction was, look, I've known this guy for a half hour and he's already done 2 huge things in his life that were completely independent of other people.
Yeah. I don't think codependent. I think we have a different definition of codependency. I think the opposite of codependency is healthy dependence, right? So it's not no dependence, it's healthy dependence. And for me, like, I wasn't in my body until my mom died. Because I was in her, she lived inside of me. And she, like, when she, the way that my mom reacted to me as a kid, my whole entire life was, if I wasn't doing what she wanted, she'd be like, oh, my arms went numb today and they're not doing what I want. And I would get in these like hours long crying, please, like, that's not how I feel. That's not what I think. And she'd be like, yes, you do. And she would tell me what I thought. And that was like really damaging. And then she would finally break me. I would cry and then she'd be like, I love you, let's go get ice cream. And also when she died, I died, so I'm like half dead, or I consider myself partly. We were so enmeshed and our fabrics are so intertwined. I relate to this like feminist idea that, you know, we're all living our mom's unlived lives. My mom wanted to meet an artist and move to New York City. I did that. My mom loved the Talking Heads. I worked with David Byrne for 4 years and I told him, you know, my mom would be happy, and he's like, yeah, whatever, cool. But we're all the skies in the tree. We're all God talking to itself, and we can talk about it, and it's interesting to hold the tension of it, but ultimately there isn't a difference.
So on that point, because one of the things we'll ask people is, was there music that you look back on from other people, whether a particular band, a particular album, a particular song, a genre, where you were like, this really helped on my mental health journey, this really got me through?
Oh man, all of it. You know, I think the mental health journey is really a spectrum also, and a tension between rage and transcendence. And that's pretty much the arc of, that's the only thing available to artists. And that's really the only story you can tell. And like, it's sort of from like Black Flag to spiritual music or something. But like Black Flag is also spiritual music.
Yeah. Tell me, when you're saying rage versus transcendence, tell me about those things. That I'm curious about that idea.
Well, rage, like anxiety and depressions, are 2 ways of saying you're not feeling, like you've gone past the spectrum of feeling. So rage is not anger, it's like past, it's like an emergency switch. So it's like rage getting into anger, and then behind anger is always sadness, and behind sadness is like all the other feelings. And then if you can get into all the other feelings, you've now transcended and you've made a piece of art that might last forever. You know?
Yeah. And so it's interesting that you say that, because to me, I think about rage the way you're talking about with sometimes again, like maybe alcohol or whatever you have to do. I kind of feel like one of the things that people seem to struggle with is sometimes there is this sense like you need something to just break out. And then if you don't break out, you're gonna get kind of consumed by some kind of system. And it's sort of like people like, oh, they're so angry, they're so whatever. And it's like, yeah, I guess, but you're not hearing the bigger process. You're not hearing that. Like, to me, that's transcending. You're like, I don't know how to say this, but I'm not going gently into that particular good night. You know,
oh, that's
moment.
Beautiful. I mean, like, you're touching on something I really love, which is most people think that the concept of love is like this really polite thing. Like, love doesn't give a shit what you think or what you want. It just takes what it wants, when it wants, how it wants on its own terms. Like, there's a John Lennon quote I think a lot about who says, you know, life is what happens when you're busy making plans.
Who's also the only person that's allowed to talk about God. Everyone else can't, but he's allowed. I think we can.
Well, because he wrote this Marxist masterpiece, right? Which is, there is no heaven, there is no, you know, all that, right? It's like he was like, of course God is stupid, but let's talk about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's interesting because when I think people talk about your band, that's one of the things that they'll talk about. It's like, and again, I don't know if I read this right, but it's like, it's sort of like giving people permission to lose it. You know, back when there was this like
transcendence,
kind of,
dance yeah, music culture. Sort of, yeah.
And there's that kind of sense of like, all right, like, I mean, I like as an example, like I never lose it at a concert. I love sitting. I don't care. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's like when I saw like Napalm Death and the Melvins. Right. I'm like,
I'm just talking.
Like, I'm just thought I'd throw that at you. Yeah. I'm just sitting there and I'm just taking it all in. I'm like, oh my God. And especially for whatever reason, like Dale Kroger.
The first girl I lived with is married to Dale Kroger, FYI.
This is totally unrelated to anything, but why not give him I don't know. Maybe it was live or something. I was just like, oh my God, that guy can hit. I just was sort of there being like, sure. Like, I just
like
cannot
a drum
believe
genius.
This.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it's like, I was like,
was he in his underwear that particular show? My favorite thing is when he wears tidy whities and puts his drumsticks in the side of his,
I have to confess that I did not notice, the underwear, but he may not have been wearing underwear at all for all I know.
No, he's not fully.
But
naked.
I will always lean up against the wall and take it in. And so it was so funny when I think I was reading a review of you guys that was like, okay, like those people are boring. This is a band that's giving get out there.
That was our entire mission, was to allow the indie kids to not stand on the wall with their arms folded. And we succeeded. I mean, listen, dance music fully took over and now it's, you know, Electric Daisy Carnival or something that I'm not connected to particularly, but you know, we succeeded. DFA, my generation of kids, but the British people understood how to do that. So it was really connecting sort of British rave culture. One of my favorite records is Screamadelica by Primal Scream, or, you know, I was a big Happy Mondays fan, or just like a lot of acid house stuff, like 808, just a lot of British dance music. You know, there's a great book called Last Night a DJ Saved My Life. I'm really influenced by music journalism and documentaries and stuff. I'm basically like, you know, my dad's professor friends are just like, you're just like a professor of like, it's exactly the same. Like the way you talk about music is very similar.
Yeah, no, I get a lot of shit because like I honestly don't watch very much that's not music documentaries or read much. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the last time I read a book that was not a music documentary book, and I'll read like the same ones over and over. Like I'll read like American Hardcore or Our Band Could Be Your Life or
Yeah, I mean, well, because yeah, sure. I mean, so the other side of that is Last Night a DJ Could Say My. I mean, The Rapture is really could be summed up in two books. You know, Our Band Could Be Your Life, and then the other one is Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, and we're like straight down the middle. And our job is to be the conduit for, you know, Minor Threat and Acid House or whatever, you know, like disco culture, like New York gay, you know, because at the time I moved to New York because I read a book called Please Kill Me. And the two bands I really loved the most were Suicide and Television. And they came up in the same era as Larry Levan and The Loft and all that stuff. And that was kind of like DFA was like, we got together and we're like, wow, you're the only other person I know that likes these two things together.
So this is totally, and we'll probably have to edit this out, but when you guys were coming out, I was playing music in a band. I won't say the name, but we were playing all the local places, like the Arlene's, Continental, yeah, North Six, all that.
New York
and
City.
So we were basically, you know, just metal, and we were just marginalized basically because of like guys like you guys
wrecked
were, like,
your life.
Yeah, you guys yeah, were, sure. honestly, sorry, you did yeah. stuff. I remember being I'm like, sorry. What? I was like, yeah. why is nobody here? But
there's a philosophical shift. Yeah.
One of our first shows, I think it was at Keddie's Castaway. Like, so the, Marty Rev was at one of our shows.
I used to see him all the time. I sent him at the post office.
I didn't know who he was because I wasn't familiar with Suicide at that point. And I just met it. He was so cool. And then when I interviewed him and Alan, I just remember being like, oh my God, this music is so fucking good.
It's transcendent. Like, there is no Depeche Mode. There is no, I mean, like we played with Suicide. You're saying, I love how he like punches keyboard, but like I met him. We played a festival with him in Ohio and we shared the same dressing room, and he lived in San Diego in Lemon Grove, which is the next door to me. So when I was growing up, Martin Rev was next to me, and like, you know, Suicide is why I moved to New York City. Early Rapture song, like I quote them in one of the lyrics of in our first EP. And when I moved here, I met this Japanese girl that was like obsessed with Alan Vega, and I would go to her house and smoke weed, and she had all this, you know, all of his records. I met his wife. I did a tribute to Suicide, and friend of mine asked me to do it. I sang Cherie, I think, and his wife was there, and I got to give her a hug. And my life plan was, she is a lawyer and she kind of just took care of him, and my life plan was move to New York, find some professional woman who can take care of me, and I can just do my shitty art career for the rest of my life. And that was my plan. I got to tell her that story, and you know, we became friends and stuff like that, so it's very cute.
Yeah, no, and it's like, and I think, you know, because you, if I'm remembering correctly, I think one of my favorite quotes from Lester Bangs was, I think hardcore is the womb. And you, I think you said something similar about that with the connection between like the hardcore and like the more intense dance music that you guys were doing. We're talking about the bridge between Minor Threat, and you know, it's like, it's, there's that immersive, and we get back to the original concepts of like what brings people out, what gives them faith at something.
It's like permission.
Yeah, what gives them what the immersive nature of certain kinds of music, just knowing that you can feel a certain way. I think early hip hop was that, you know, 100%. People were doing like fun, like when people were doing fun hip hop in the Bronx or wherever, it's like
transcend.
I think Curtis Blow might have said this, or it might be MC Shock. They both might have said it, but it's like they were like, the premise of being able to feel good in the middle of despair is so powerful. It's
That's a beautiful way to say it.
Yeah. And so you guys like really went right there.
And that saved my life. That was the way out. And you know, my job on stage is to give permission for people to not think about themselves and to channel. And you know, you want to see the Melvins, right? Like they channel something. There's permission there. And the best music allows you to forget that you have a body. And from forgetting that you have a body, you can now enter your body and have a first experience of being human.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, thank you so much for, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. I love it too.
And, I'm so great that you're going to be touring again, and like, you know, just wish you the best of luck, and just the fact that you're going into that, not going into, but that you've been coaching and all that stuff, it's really inspiring stuff. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you too. I really feel like we got to connect here, and I'm happy for people to be able to check it out.
So there it is, Luke Jenner of The Rapture, and how he coped with hopelessness, particularly when dealing with his mom's bipolar disorder and eventual suicide. Now, there is so much to take away from the conversation with Luke, but I wanted to focus on something that he said towards the end of our discussion, which is the concept of giving yourself permission to not think about yourself. Now, this concept is so important, especially if we struggle with hopelessness. When we struggle with our mental health in general, our feelings can often feel so pervasive, so permanent, and so painful that we just can't escape them. And that in and of itself can make us feel hopeless. Will we ever get any relief? And sometimes when we're dealing with such a stressful situation, like a parent who is struggling, we may not feel like we even deserve to take a break from our suffering. And so the simple but kind act of giving ourselves permission to take a break from our struggles, to not think about our pain, can be the relief we crave and the hope and empowerment we need to make changes in our lives. And for many of us, music and concerts are one of the only places where we allow that for ourselves. But it's important to try and check in with ourselves. Is there anything, including music, that makes us feel even a little bit better, that allows us to take our mind away from the pain, even just for a moment? Maybe reading, watching our favorite shows, getting outside, exercising, or spending time with people who we like and trust. If we can't find anything, that's okay. We can keep looking. Now, this can be a very tricky process, because if we are always giving ourselves permission to not think about things, that may turn into avoidance or suppression, which can actually make things worse rather than better. And if we are repeatedly engaging in harmful behavior, such as drugs, alcohol, it could lead us down the path of addiction. But if we can give ourselves permission, maybe once a day to start, to not think about our problems, it may open us up to other possibilities. New feelings, new coping strategies, new creative ventures, new possibilities in work or our relationships. Giving ourselves permission to not think about our struggles can be the beginning of giving ourselves permission to survive and eventually thrive. I want to thank Luke for this wonderful conversation. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. And I, of course, want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and SoundMind Live for including me in this wonderful project. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. If you are struggling with anxiety, depression, or addiction and are looking for help, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Helpline at 1-800-622-4357. If you're thinking about harming yourself and want to seek help, please contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. You may also go to the Sound Mind Live and Consequence websites for more information. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the Crossroads.
Jorge Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell. Mark Mother's Bathroom Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from County Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season 4. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.